Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of the Anything But Typical podcast. I'm going to ask you guys a question. Think of someone named Jack Black. Got an image? Think of School of Rock. Got an image? Well, that is George Ramsey. So, this is going to be fun, George. I've always wanted to interview Jack Black, and so this is going to be fun. So, knowing that you were a soccer player in college, D1 at Davidson, and you're still playing soccer, even though you've got an 8-month that is keeping you from sleeping, you're still playing soccer in your leagues. So here's the deal. You've got your stinky shin guards on. You're going from the parking lot and you're going to a soccer field, and somebody new in the parking lot is like, whoa, 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 that's George Ramsey. And they start talking about you, not realizing that you can overhear and understand every word they're saying about you. What would you want somebody to say about you?
Well, I would say as prior to 8 months ago, I would say, oh, you know, a nice guy, an honest, hardworking entrepreneur who cares about people, which is all true. But I think now it would be, he's a great dad. I think that would be the first thing that I would want people to say.
Isn't that amazing how children do that?
Snap of a finger.
Yep. Yeah, you become a different human being really quick.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I love it.
So for those that don't know George, George is the owner of Bold Music. We're going to dive into that whole story and what inspired you to do that. But I want you to take us back into, what was your first exposure to music?
So I had I'm the youngest of three, and I have two older siblings who are both very musical. I have a dad who's very musical. My mom jokes that she can play the jukebox or whatever, you know, like the stereo. But we were put in lessons, you know, from a very young age. Like I started learning piano before I could remember. Like I don't even really remember my first teacher, whose name was Edith Ann in Atlanta. So it was just one of those things where our parents were like, this is important, you got to do it. So I kind of came up through the classical piano tradition. So I had my first teacher when I don't even remember, and then eventually had a, you know, maybe when I was age 7 or something, we moved to a Juilliard-trained Japanese teacher named Keiko, in Atlanta, who was fantastic. And that was sort of my intro to music. No disrespect towards Keiko, no disrespect towards Edith Ann. I hated it. Hated it with a passion. I was not good at it. I wasn't good at reading music. I didn't want to practice. My older brother and sister were way better than me at it. So I used to, like, fake being sick to like not have to go to my piano lesson. So you like have that image in your head and you're like, so this guy ended up being a musician of the three? How does that work?
I remember getting music or piano lessons really early on, and the thing we were most excited about was they had a basketball hoop. So when it wasn't our turn to play, yes, we could go outside and play basketball.
Yes. Yes. The waiting room was like, you gotta have the amenities in the waiting room, right, to keep people interested. Yep.
So what changed? If you absolutely hated it, you've got older siblings that are really good at it, which very easily can be discouraging in its own right. What changed to where you now are? Obviously, this is your life and your career.
Yeah, so once I got towards, I think it was the end of middle school, I grew like a foot in a year, and I had growing pains. I had it in my knees, I had the stress fractures in my hip and my back, so I actually had to like stop playing soccer. You know, the first 10, 15 years of my life, super focused on soccer. I was forced to take a year off, and I picked up the guitar. And a couple things changed. Number one, my best friend Joe down the street had been taking guitar lessons, and he had a teacher that came to his house who was really cool. And they learned music that they liked. Yeah. And they learned how to improvise, and they played rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. So it was like, oh, I can learn an instrument that actually interests me and music that actually interests me. And that's really what changed. I mean, I got a guitar, I think it was for Christmas, if not like right before, you know, a few weeks after I had to like hang up the boots for a year for soccer. And I just immediately just immersed myself in it. And that was like what I did. And I think there's a lot of kids that age who really get into music have a similar thing. Something clicks in their head and they're just like, oh, this is what. And so I would practice 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day kind of thing. That didn't keep up, but like there was a good few years where that's all I did. So that was it. It was playing an instrument that I felt drawn to, that was my own, wasn't in like the shadows of my brother and sister, and playing music, you know, that I really resonated with.
Did that become the dream of, I love the guitar so much, I want to make a career out of that?
It did. I mean, it was so interesting, and it probably had something to do with like puberty and getting older and realizing I was good at soccer, but I wasn't going to be like in the English Premier League.
Right.
Like as I got into high school, it was pretty crystal clear in my head. It's like, I got to do music. I got to do music in some capacity.
Yep.
I didn't know how it would be. I mean, I think early on, like all budding musicians, the idea of being in a, you know, big rock band and going on tour and all that kind of stuff, that's probably what I envisioned. And then I started making beats and producing music and stuff like that, and maybe I thought I would want to be a producer. So there's a whole, I mean, I could talk about this forever. But yeah, I mean, I was fortunate, I guess, in that I was like, this is my lane. I'm going to do something with music.
It's interesting you make that comment about soccer, though, because you still went on to play Division I soccer, which any Division I sport is an unbelievable feat in itself. How did you balance continuing to play soccer and focusing on that clearly enough to evolve and develop into a legitimate player?
That's a really good question. And maybe this is like some of the, I don't know, like imposter syndrome that drives a lot of entrepreneurs too. But I would say by partway through high school, I knew I was good. But it was really that, like, I was getting looks from colleges and things like that, because it was like, okay, this guy's got good grades. I literally remember, like, he gets good grades. He's a smart guy. He'll bring the GPA up. Coaches would say that to me. You know what I mean? And so I was like, okay, well, I think I have a ticket here. I think I have a ticket to leave, you know, leave Atlanta and go somewhere new, go to a school. Again, my brother and sister both went to Emory in Atlanta. My dad was a doctor at Emory. The deal was, if I didn't want to go to Emory, and we got free tuition there because my dad was there, and there was like that. Yep. They changed it, but the deal with my dad was like, you got to get a scholarship, you know, of some kind. I didn't have a full ride.
Yeah.
But you got to get a scholarship to a better school than Emory if you want to leave. So I think it was more like in my head, it was like, okay, well, I'll just keep plugging away at soccer because I have a feeling that's my ticket. And it was like that was how that's kind of how that played in. But I never really looked at myself as a legitimate, like, I mean, from probably age 16 on, I was like, okay, I'm good enough to play in college, but that's about it.
You didn't go to Davidson to play soccer. That was just one of the things you were doing.
Yes, and it was more so I wanted to get out of Atlanta. Well, I love Atlanta. I thought I would go back, but like I just wanted to get out and experience something new. Soccer was sort of the way out, not necessarily like I was pretty burned out on soccer by the time I graduated high school.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you said something about imposter syndrome on the soccer side. Have you ever dealt with that as a musician or entrepreneur?
It across the board. It's the same with music, same with entrepreneurship, same with soccer. I've thought a lot about it from the soccer perspective as of late, and I'm bringing myself to think about it from the music perspective. I'm on a soccer team with like ex-professionals.
Wow.
Seriously, I am like legitimately an imposter on that team. But as I've gotten older and I've got a kid and my perspective changes, it's like, who cares? Like, it doesn't affect me in a way that's going to like affect my mindset or my performance. It's just like, I know who I am and I'm comfortable with that. I wish I had that in a way when I was like 18 years old or 16 years old. Same exact thing with music. I was a really hardworking gigging musician for a long time. So I sort of cut my teeth enough to be good and legit, and like everyone was like, okay, like this guy can play. But in my own head, I was never comfortable with that. Like I knew it's kind of like soccer. It's like I'm good at music. I'm naturally pretty gifted at it. I did work hard at it. But I also knew where the ceiling was. And I knew I have enough other interests. I do other things. I'm social. To get from here to like here, I guess we're on a podcast.
Yeah,
to get from like, you know, professional to like virtuoso, just like an inch, if it's a graph, like a tiny little bit better would take so much more work and practice, and it would require me just like being locked up in my room all day. I knew it wasn't gonna happen. So I kind of like, it's not even that I felt the imposter syndrome. It was like, I'm passable and I'm good, but I'm not like, mm-hmm. I'm nothing special.
Yeah. There's an analogy of, I don't remember where a study was, but most topics, if you read 3 books on that topic, you know more about that than 95% of the world. Mm. But getting from 95 to 99 is where the true experts end up shining.
Exactly. So I would say, you know, from the sports and music perspective, I'm at like that 97, which is great. Yeah. Like most, and I'm thankful to have like a gift, I guess you could say. But there's a big difference between 97 and 98, right. You know? But yeah. And then in a business perspective, I'm shameless about it. I know I don't know much, you know, I've been doing it for 10 years, but, not like I have a business degree. It's not like I worked in corporate America and know how this is supposed to be done. So it's almost an asset in business, I would say.
Yeah, I'm curious. Knowing as many musicians as I do know that are even professional in Nashville and various places, there is always that comparison, and it's usually the measure of success is who you playing for, are you headlining, blah blah blah, right? And tremendous insecurities among pretty much everyone that I know.
Oh yeah.
Because it's always this comparison trap.
Yep.
You said something that was gold, and anybody listening to this, you said, but I know who I am. I can feel like an imposter, but at some point I don't care because I know who I am. Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very important thing that, you know, at a much younger age than I ever was to understand that, which, you know, you could say, well, yeah, I wish I would have known that at 18. Thank God you know it. Now you do.
Right? Most people go through life never figuring that out.
Yeah. Well, it kind of takes some pressure off, right? I don't, mm-hmm. And in the music world, I don't have to, I know that I'm not going to do what it takes to be that 98, 99, 100 percentile musician. I just know I'm not going to do it. Like, mm-hmm. And so it's like, why am I going to continue to like, you know, hurt or like be hard on myself when I know I'm not going to do what it takes to get there? Why not just be like good with, you know, I'm good with what I've got, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you had this gift that you developed, you worked very intentionally on it, but then you've got to be feeling pressure. Okay, you're in college, you punch out of soccer after your sophomore year, I want to focus on music, now what? Like, what are you going to do with this, George?
Mm.
Did you ever have that question?
I did. And you know, I give my parents a lot of credit. They were pretty hands-off. They didn't steer me. And now that I'm thinking about it, and like, you know, 8 months as if I know everything, now that I'm a dad to an infant, it wasn't a heavy dose of pressure from either of my parents. They were going through their own. They had divorced while I was in high school, which is another whole thing. So, like, they had a lot to worry about on their own.
Yeah.
But so the deal was, when I quit playing soccer, Davidson is an expensive school. I lost my scholarship. My dad was like, you got to do something. You got to earn some money, you know, to at least like chip in here. Right. Otherwise you can leave. So I got a job teaching. So my friend at Davidson, Dean, who I went on to start Bold Music with, couple years older than me, he was teaching at a studio not far from there. He got me a job there. So I almost didn't even have time to think about it, right? Like, I quit playing soccer. I was like, okay, now I'm going to do music. Oh, I'm going to get a job. Oh, I can teach. So I started teaching. And I mean, we could, I'd have to ask Dean, like, when the conversation started. But it was quick when we were like, oh, wait a minute. These guys, like, we can do this. You know what I mean? Like, we could do a business like this and do it a lot better than what we're seeing. This guy seems to be paying the bills. Like,
yeah.
So, you know, I wish there was some innovative idea behind it, but it was more that, you know, I was like, okay, I need to go get a job and make some money. I like music. This is an easy thing to kind of move into. Mm. And very soon after starting that, it was very easy to see that, like, Dean and I are both smart. We both have, like, an entrepreneurial itch. We could totally do this on our own. So that's kind of how that started. So
you had your own musical journey, right? Of the exposure to classical piano, not really liking it, finding the guitar, going to school for it. How did that influence the vision for what Bold Music would become?
Heavily, heavily, heavily. So, and I will say, over the years, we've had to almost, like, it started out as a big advantage, and then I think in a way it became a crutch over the years, because I was so full on, like, well, this was my experience. I got to make sure we do it. When now we're realizing, as we've grown and we've got all these different teachers and fans, like, we got to listen to what the customers want here. A great example of that is, for 10 years, we never did formal recitals because I hated the formal recitals that I would do, because I was underprepared. I didn't practice. Everyone was better than me. It's like, it all makes perfect sense. But we would do, so for Bold Music, we did gig nights. Those are our big, they're big shows. And we do those four times a year. And I was very resistant to doing a formal recital. And Peyton, who's our teacher support specialist, who's been with us for a long time, but came over full time, just over a year ago. He's way classical, like classical tradition. He was like, dude, we have to do formal recital. So finally I was like, okay, let's do it. And of course, like, super popular, amazing event. Like, we're doing them a lot now. So early on, I guess the concept was, on a broad level, let's deliver music lessons to your house. For two reasons. I had teachers like that. Dean had teachers like that. Way nicer to just jam at your house on your own stuff than to go to somebody else's house. And we thought correctly that it was more convenient for parents. And learn and play and keep it fun. The goal doesn't have to be to, like, go do these piano competitions and get as good as you can get, and, like, just like you would do with sports. The goal is have fun and stick with it. Because we would continue to get parents who are like, yeah, I want to sign my kid up for music lessons. God, I regret that I dropped it when I was a kid. And it's like, yeah, well, the antidote to that is making it fun and making your kid want to do it. So, like, my experience heavily influenced. But at the same token, I also knew that the fundamentals and technique and things like that are very important in music theory. A lot of the benefits of the classical kind of tradition. So it really, like, the kind of the vision of it really was, it came directly out of my childhood and Dean's childhood experience, and just, like, how would we tweak this to make it better?
Mm-hmm. So you're doing both the gig night versions, because my neighbors have kids that, and so anybody listening, get this straight, all right? The music teachers come to your house. And then the recitals that I saw of my neighbors were like Jack Black.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it was, like School of Rock. And I'm like, this is awesome. Yeah. You know? And parents are posting it on social media, and I'm like, Lawton, way to go, man.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's so cool.
Where do you host those?
We do them at Heist Barrel Arts here. So that's like but there's like an event, they have like a little venue in the back of it. So there's the second location down, like, near Camp North End. Mm-hmm. So that's where we do those.
Which has to be a ton of fun for the kids also, because it gets to feel like they're performing in a concert.
We pack the thing out.
Setting.
Yeah, we pack the thing out. It's a show. I mean, it's a show. We've got there's hundreds of people in there. We've got a professional sound guy. We have a professional backing band. We have teachers in I mean, it's a whole operation. But we now also have the formal recitals. Yep. We do that at a really cool new place called the Long Room, which is kind of like a tango salsa event space where it's cool. It's in Plaza Midwood. And so we do all sorts of things. Tonight, we're doing an adults-only open mic at the Evening Muse. So like we do, we want to have stuff for everybody. And we do, we try our best to do it.
So you take kids of all ages, including adults, like talk about the types of instruments or even vocals doing mm-hmm. that too?
Yeah, so we work with a whole range, like from age 4 to 80. You know what I mean? But we'll work with anybody. The majority of our students are typically elementary and middle school. And we'll get, we have a preschool program too. We'll get kids at age like 4 or 5, like TK in private lessons sometimes. And then a whole range of instruments. The big ones are piano, guitar, and voice. Mm-hmm. But we've got drum teachers, bass, violin, saxophone, you know, a lot of, we hit pretty much everything. There's a few that we don't really have a trumpet teacher, for example, but mm-hmm. and we're not really geared to be like the private lesson provider for like orchestra, you know, kids yeah. that need extra help for orchestra or like symphonic band in high school or something like that. But we have some teachers who kind of we have some teachers who can do some of that, but that's not really the kind of the focus.
Let's talk about the business, because not all musicians, in my experience, are very good business people. And that's not a knock. It's just like, hey, they know their craft. And then, so the business side, and even going from performing to teaching, man, that's a mm-hmm. those are like two different worlds, right? So talk to us about, yeah, you like performing, but then you were teaching. Then like, hey, we can make this a business. Talk about some of those transitions and what do you really like?
So it's very true that not all performers are good teachers. So yeah. we've, over the years, and it's still a work in progress, really tried to hone in on what it is that we need in a teacher. And it's also true, and there's things that have nothing to do with music that it really boils down to. Like, obviously, we almost take like your skill and ability on the instrument for granted. If you're going to apply to work with us, presumably you've got that skill. It's a lot of the soft skills, like communication, dependability. You know, are you going to be a good role model? Do you value community? What books do you read? You know, stuff like that we're trying to use to screen out our candidates. Because at the end of the day, they're coming to your house. It's not yeah, like they're right. coming into a studio. Right. Like, they're coming to your house. These are people that you have to be comfortable with in your house. So it ends up being, I wouldn't go so far as to say a needle in a haystack, but finding the right teachers is a big challenge for us as a business. And I think, so we need that type of person, but you don't have to be business savvy, right? So like a lot of our teachers are fantastic, and they're piecing together a living. They're gigging. A lot of them are highly educated, but the idea of running their own teaching business is yeah. just not yeah. appealing. And I don't blame them. I do it. There's like a very fragmented market. A lot of independent teachers like run their own studios. They just manage their and there's a lot of headaches and issues that go along with that. You can make more money, obviously, because you're not working for a company that's going to take a cut of the revenue. But you're dealing with a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with music, has nothing to do with your craft, has nothing yeah. to do with education. So I think we definitely serve like a really valuable role for these musicians. But I don't know. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And I'm just curious about in the stuff that makes you come alive, your Thrive Zones. I'm looking, and I wish you guys could see this. You have tremendous branding.
Oh, yeah, baby.
I mean, you got a big yellow O with a guitar pick and the neck and the tuning part of the guitar. I'm a drummer, so I don't
headstock,
know. Headstock. I don't even know what you call that. But, yeah, so I'm just a dumb drummer. But it's very good. The experience that you guys deliver, from what I've seen from my neighbors that our clients, very good. You're doing the logistics, which nobody wants to do, the marketing and securing sales, nobody wants to do that, very few, at least in the music world. And a lot of people aren't, like, they don't want to do that. They right. just want to go do what they do. Mm-hmm. So How have you, from the time that you've started this thing, like, hey, we could actually make a living doing this, to now, how have you kind of moved through those things to determine, like, man, these are the things that I really dig, and these are the things that I don't, and how do you supplement the stuff that you don't now that you've got some additional people?
Yeah, so I think the fundamental piece was kind of convincing myself that my goal and mission and passion is to support musicians rather than be a musician, if that makes sense. And that really helped. And it wasn't like I actually convinced myself. I realized I actually like doing this. I get a lot of energy from being a supporter of local musicians, especially the ones who are, you know, the good people to work with, basically. Right. It's like, I want to work for them. I want to go to bat for them and make them, make their lives easier and make them, you know, have success in music. The lesson business is just one way to do that. And then the other piece is just people, right? So I had to convince myself that this is something I actually want to do. And I do, I love it. Never once woken up and been like, I'm dreading work. I enjoy it. Right. But getting people in place who can kind of help execute on that vision. And then over the years, you know, it used to be me doing that. I was a teacher. I was doing the sales. I was doing the marketing. I was doing the billing. I was doing all that stuff.
Early business, right?
Early, yeah. I was hustling. Yeah. Slowly, kind of bring more people into the fold. It allows you to do more things. And so I've found a lot of enjoyment in the challenge of business. Mm-hmm. You know, and like each different phase of the business, you know, the life cycle of the business has brought on new and equally fun challenges. And I will say I'm coming on the tail of two very stressful months, but, you know, I think it was like yesterday morning, just like sitting down on my computer feeling stressed, I was like, wait a minute, like, this is great. I can sit here and be like, and feel stressed and feel like, why, like, you know, I don't know, feel like everyone's out to get me or whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But like, I chose this and I like this and I like a challenge. And I truly wouldn't have it any other way. And it, like, for as much stress as there is, and much there's new, like this year or last year, it was lead generation. This year I'm realizing we have major process issues. And it's just like, how fun is it to like every year have a whole new batch of things you have to focus on instead of just like, you know, working on the same stuff all the time.
That's a great thing for a lot of the listeners to hear, because you're almost 11 years into running this business and yet you're still discovering things that need to be fixed. Right. And so many people go into business thinking, okay, it's going to suck for a couple of years and then we're going to be good. Right. And that is never the case. There's always something else that you need to adjust or change or pivot.
Yeah.
So it's a good lesson.
It's great. Yeah. I mean, and I would go so far as to say, does anyone, like, would you really not want it to be like that? Like,
you'd get bored.
As an entrepreneur, you might have, like, in your mind that, oh, I want to just get this all figured out and have it. But, like, if you're really true to yourself, you don't want that. Like, you want challenges. Mm-hmm. You want excitement. You want things to be fluid. So
you would just go out and find something else that you can challenge you, right?
Exactly.
So you've talked about your people a few times and about the screening process, make sure you get the right people in. But I'm curious, how do you ensure the quality, the compatibility with your clients? Because you're not there all the time, right? So how do you ensure that people are getting that same consistent, high quality experience you want?
Another big challenge. The bigger we get, the tougher. So, we could talk for 3 hours on this topic alone. So it's like there's a bunch of different facets to it. It starts with the hiring process, and we've realized in the past year we've had. So I used to do all the hiring. Then we hired a full time recruiter who's no longer with us. Hi Desiree, she's amazing, but she got another job, and I was like, just, you got to go do this. Right. You know what I mean? So there was some learning for her to figure out, okay, how do I hire good people? We really didn't have processes. She built a really nice process. When she left, Peyton, who I mentioned earlier, teacher support specialist, he took over the hiring. It's hard. Hiring is hard. So we've spent a lot of time in the past couple months rebuilding our hiring process again, focusing on core values, really to kind of just screen and knowing, like, we'll probably hire one out of 30 candidates. So it's hard. I mean, it takes a long time, a hard work to find a good teacher, but we're getting closer and closer to the point to where we know if you're getting through the process, you're legit and you're gonna be good. There's always gonna be turnover. That's another thing I've learned as we've grown and we have like 85, 90 teachers now. Well, there's always somebody quitting. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's not like, it's almost like there's somebody's job needs to just be reassigning students of the teacher who's quit this week or this month, right? So there's the hiring piece. And then the teacher support role was a role that we created a year and a half ago. Peyton, who I've mentioned a few times now, stepped into that. He's a teacher himself. We put him in full time to his entire job is to support and help our team of teachers. So he does the onboarding of new teachers and he's constantly providing support and oversight to help them do a good job. And it's a challenge because one of the things that's important to me is not to tell every teacher how to do their job. We need to empower them to meet their students where they are and use their own experience and expertise to do a good job. But like, they still have to do a good job. So one of the things that we're working on this year, in addition to the hiring, the teacher support, the matching process, we call it our personalized matching process. That's important. We get a lot of info from we know a lot about our teachers and we get a lot of info from the families and it's like matchmaking.
Yeah.
And then it's the continual support. And that's something that I'll just admit we haven't done a great job of in the past. We've just had, you know, we basically get students signed up and we tell the teacher, good luck. Keep them enrolled, keep them happy. Mm-hmm. This year we're implementing some more support to help kind of after enrollment, how can we continue to support, make sure we're getting feedback from the family, make sure we're checking in with the teacher and getting them to basically do like progress reports, not telling them you have to teach this way, you have to use this book, you have to teach them this songs, but a general oversight on, okay, let's get a heat check on how the family's feeling and liking this relationship, and teacher, how do you feel the student's doing and how do you feel you're doing? So that's, I'm excited about that this year because I think it's going to really take our service to the next level.
Well, to the point of your experience, if you were telling all of your teachers teach a certain way, you're not going to reach a lot of people.
Right.
Right. What may have worked for your siblings didn't work for you. Something else worked for you and it clicked.
Exactly.
And if you never got that second experience, we wouldn't be talking right now.
Yeah.
So giving your people the freedom to go be themselves, and as long as you're high quality and taking care of your clients, I think that empowerment is massive.
Yeah, it really is, and it's such a creative space in music. Like we can't be telling people how to do, like, and everyone's musical journey is unique and awesome, and it's like one of our best teachers, Mars. His name is Mario, but he goes by Mars. He's been with us forever. He now lives in Tacoma, Washington. He didn't like go to study music in college or anything like that. He like got into the gigging game and teaching game as like a teenager, and he's been doing it ever since. And he's like unbelievable as a musician, as a human, as a teacher. So like, it's just like hiring great people in our world is not like, let me look at your resume and see how, like, it requires more kind of like subjective judgment. It's hard, but we have to do a really good job of bringing them on and then also empowering them to just do their thing within the confines of what's going to keep their customers happy.
Yeah, that creativity is a really big point because we're in BGW CPA right now. They're going to want their CPAs doing things a very specific way, right? You don't want CPAs going out and getting creative.
Improvising on their tax return.
Yeah, exactly. But in your world, it's a necessity, and all of the people in that world are that way, right? They're not the ones that are going to be the most process-oriented. They're going to be the ones that are more creative and have that type of brain that a CPA may not necessarily have.
And I'm right in the middle, I will say. I'm not a creative genius, but I'm decently creative, and I'm not a process genius, but I know enough to be dangerous about both. So it's one of those things where it's like, okay, I can see that this is my little superpower here, because I can empathize with this side and I can empathize with this side, and somehow for the most part get it to work together, and I'm happy to do that
because you probably get to play as the glue in bold, right? Of the creative plus the business of how do I glue that all together?
Yep, exactly.
And I think that is a key part of business,
mm-hmm.
even in the accounting world.
Oh yeah,
because what we have found, and the reason we see success, is because most CPA firms are not creative at all.
Mm-hmm.
In a very complex tax code, and they typically self-select into the most conservative position possible. But we have people that are very creative in the tax code, not creative like, hey, let's go skirt the law or anything ethically. No, they would lose their CPA and we wouldn't keep them.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of latitude, mm-hmm. but not everybody is wired that way, so you have to have a mix. Just like in your business, you have to have a mix. So I think that's really very self-aware about you. I want to go back to another comment that you made. You said, you know, part of your hiring process, 1 out of 30, and that you do a lot in core values. That's a very interesting thing. A common theme, really.
Mm. No, we've never talked about that here.
Yes.
But I want to hear, like, how did you even recognize, hey, that's kind of an important thing if we're going to start this business? And then how did you uncover what your core values that you said, like, hey, we're going to live and die by these things? And then how did you infiltrate that and, like, nurture that within your company?
It's so jargony, the core values thing. You know what I mean? Like, part of me hates it, but it's so critical. I can't take credit for it. I was a member of the EO Entrepreneurs Organization Accelerator Program a few years ago. I'm now actually the president of it this year, up until July. So I'm gonna plug that. There was a mentor coach in that world named Mario Mendigana, who owns an industrial cleaning company. Awesome guy, really cool, like, immigration story too. And we were just at a learning day one day, and we just started talking about core values, and he just, whatever he said, I don't even remember what he said, but whatever he said clicked for me. And this was 6 years into the business, where it's like, oh, we don't have core values. Oh, geez. Yeah. Like, we got to figure this out.
Mm.
And I don't even really remember the exercise, but I remember it took about 30 minutes for me to hammer out what I thought our core values were. And we haven't touched them. And they're right. It's teacher first, number one. So it's a weird thing to say for a service for students, but it's
cool.
We're here to support musicians. And in order for us to support you, you got to be great at what you do. Otherwise, we can't support you. Teacher first, relationship driven, exceptional service, community, and always improving. And really what it is it's an extension of what I care about personally. Not business at all, really. It's just like the type of people that I like and that I want to be around all care about those five things. I guess teacher first, you kind of have to be in the music world, but
yeah, but that's the same thing, right? It
serving others, industry, kind of. Yeah.
So for my business in the wealth management space, it's my job to make sure it's the best place for advisors to be,
mm-hmm.
so they can make it the best place for their clients to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that you brought that up, because I think a lot of businesses get that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They think so much about the client or the customer. They bypass their people.
Yep.
And if your people aren't your biggest fans, it's not going to translate into the client experience.
And it makes everything so much easier. We don't get it right all the time. I'm dealing with a major core value infraction at the moment.
We'll
call it that. Something that I should have seen a long time ago. So it's not, you know, we don't always get it right, but when you really sit down, I mean, another person, I can't remember who said it, was like, are you ready to lose money based on your core values?
Mm-hmm.
And if you are, then you're doing something right. And if you're not, then they're not, you're kind of full of crap.
Yeah. Gary said lots of times.
Maybe it was you, Gary.
It's not a core value if you're not willing to hire and fire based off of that.
Yeah. And it makes hiring and firing easier, you know, and it makes it feel so much less personal when, you know, you get someone who usually a teacher who's like disgruntled and ends up leaving or complaining or something. And I'm like, you know what? The more I think about this, the way this whole thing is gone, it makes perfect sense. Good luck to you. No hard feelings whatsoever. We're just not a core values fit. What you care about is not in line with what we care about. And I know that we all work really hard to do right by you. And if you're not seeing that, then mm-hmm. see you later.
I love it. You know, and you said it. It's funny. You almost were apologetic. Yeah, it feels a little fluffy. And we've seen that with so many CEOs, et cetera. But man, when you understand the power of it, like mm-hmm. when you're serious about it, like throwing words up on a page, big deal. But when you're willing to take a hit and take a bullet for it, oh no, that's a big deal. And there are economics tied to it.
Oh yeah,
without a doubt.
Right,
without a doubt. I want to go back to your branding a little bit, because like, is that one of your things or do you have somebody else? But because like, I'm like, that is a good looking brand. I mean, you know that, and you merch it well. And a lot of people don't think about that with their business, or they just outsource that. And it's okay to outsource, but it's done well.
So thank you. First of all, that's great. I'm always excited. I've been thinking a lot about marketing and branding over the past year or so. So I'm glad that you think that. This logo, we outsourced. And Dean, yeah. I will say, my co-founder Dean has a very good knack for this stuff, better than I ever did. But we paid some guy on some outsourcing website in 2013 to make our logo for $150. And I think there's a few revisions and things like that, but we settled on it pretty quick, and have had it ever since. We haven't really done anything major to it. I think what we have done from a branding perspective over the past 18 months, another topic that I could talk your ear off all day about, is really speaking to our ICP, our ideal customer persona, which, no mm-hmm. offense to either of you, tends to be mom, actually.
Sure.
Believe it or not. It's not the student. Yeah. It's not, I mean, sometimes it's the dad, for sure, but it's usually mom / parent, busy, working, tend to be relatively affluent, or just very invested in the arts, yeah. and values convenience over cost, mm-hmm. right? And so we've really tried hard from a branding perspective, not just like the visual of the logo, but over the past year or so to seriously, everything that comes out of Bold Music, we're talking to mom. We haven't gotten mm-hmm. it fully right, but we're making some great strides. And we have a teacher who's been with us for a long time. One of the strategies and priorities I have as a company is promoting from within. So giving teachers kind of expanded roles within the company as it's needed. One of our teachers who's been around for a long time, Dallas, great musician, but he's also run some really well-run, seriously good branding, some bands. And I know him well. So we brought him in 6 months ago, less than that, a few months ago, to take over our social media and all that kind of stuff. He's done by and large a fantastic job. And it's all about, like, we're just tunnel vision, like speaking to the customer at all times.
With Gary's question at the beginning of what do you want to hear people saying about you, when that comes to the same question but about Bold, is it the things you just said? Is it the convenience? Is it, what are those things you want to hear people saying when they resonate Bold, and what's the brand of that?
Yeah, yep, great question. And I think, believe it or not, I think it's like be a positive impact on my child. It doesn't even, like, the music.
Yeah.
To me, music is a skill, and you need to learn it. It's clear, like, scientifically, that it's really good for people to learn music. Mm-hmm. So that almost goes without saying. Like, we want to be inspiring, and building confidence. You know, building confidence in the students that we work with. So it's bigger. You know, bigger than music.
Right.
I'm air quoting here, people.
Yeah. Well, because most of the people you're teaching are not going to be on a stage in front of a million people playing.
And that's not the point. One of the beautiful things about music, and I guess I'm sure you can say it about like sports too, is it's all about the process. It's not really about mm-hmm. the outcome. No matter how good you get at soccer, or no matter how good you get at golf, or how good you get at guitar or piano, when you look back, you're never going to be as good as you can be. You can always continue to get better. The point of it is to go through the process of self-improvement, right? And so that's what we're trying to teach. and it's okay to not. It's okay to just enjoy that.
Yeah. There's a rental car company, I think Enterprise, mm-hmm. that they try to exclusively hire mm-hmm. previous college athletes.
Yes.
And it's because what do they come with? It's the intangible things mm-hmm. that they've learned, the teamwork, the effort, the discipline. Working towards a goal. discipline's a massive one. And yeah, I mean, to exactly what you just said, you're teaching all of those things to these students, whether they become great musicians or they go on and do something else.
Yep. And it doesn't... I mean, how good you get at the instrument really, truly, honest to God, does not matter. It doesn't. And like what my perception of good is in the music, especially in music, is not the same as what your perception of good is.
Right.
So it's really the process of learning. It wires your brain in a way that's clearly beneficial. Doesn't really matter what age you do it at. The goal for us is like, can we instill this lifelong thing for these people so that they don't give it up, and so that they have this skill that they're going to take with them forever. I mean, I don't know if you guys do public speaking, but if you think public speaking is nerve-wracking, get up on stage and try and perform by yourself or with a band, but especially by yourself. Like, there's nothing more. If you can do that, you're good. You know.
That's a good point. I did a lot with saxophone. I was in travel jazz band when I was growing up, playing coffee shops and state fairs and all that. But then doing public speaking throughout college and then after, you're right, it was easier because I was on stage and vulnerable so many times before that that you still get the adrenaline pump, but it's not the same nervousness.
It's a much tamer thing. And we tell this to students, you're going to get up on stage for the first time at gig night in front of 200 people, your brain's just going to go blank. You're going to be nervous, fingers aren't going to work.
You're probably not going to remember how you did at the end of it.
Yeah.
You'll have to watch the video.
And it's like, so don't even bother trying not to be nervous, because you're going to be nervous. Mm-hmm. So it's the process. It's, did you practice? Did you get up there and did you do it? Yeah. That's like A++ for me.
Yeah.
You know, and then the next time you'll be a little less nervous. The next time you'll be a little less nervous. And eventually it'll be no problem. It's all about the process.
That is such a refreshing perspective. Mm-hmm. It's super refreshing because I remember with my oldest son, both of my kids were soccer players too. Mm-hmm. And we spent a fortune on travel soccer and all the premier, elite levels, all of that, traveling here, there, and everywhere. And everybody's thinking, man, college scholarship. And it hit me. I think probably his junior, senior year, the oldest one, when somebody else was getting a scholarship and they were really good and they got a token to like Dayton. Like, what?
Yeah.
Dayton? This guy? That good? And the tens and tens of thousands of dollars that they spent, well, that was a bad ROI.
Oh, yeah.
A very bad ROI.
Very bad.
But I realized we are chasing, cotton candy. Mm-hmm. Like, we're just chasing an illusion but it's easy to get in that parental groupthink of this is what you're... But you brought it back down to... And think about this, anybody out there, if you are speaking or you're giving a presentation or you're doing anything that you're kind of out there... in an uncomfortable position, doing something like that on a stage is tremendous. The other thing that I think is really important that you mentioned, and a lot of people that if they think branding, they think logo, mm-hmm. they think colors, they think whatever. No. That's an element, but it's a tiny element, quite frankly. It's the rest of this package, and the fact that you have zeroed in on knowing your customer, because you even said, hey, sorry, no offense, guys, this isn't you. You got to know, because a lot of entrepreneurs make that fatal mistake of, I'll take it from anyone.
Took us 10 years to realize that. Let me just preface it.
Well, there you go. Yeah. I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah.
But the faster that you can narrow in on really understanding who your client is, the better, and the faster you're going to accelerate, just like a Venturi tube, man. Mm-hmm. It narrows and you accelerate through it.
Venturi tube.
Venturi tube, man. You don't know?
I don't.
So it's a science thing. And I'm not a big science guy, but basically what happened, it was called the Venturi effect. You have a test tube and then it narrows in the middle, and what happened is the acceleration happens in the narrow point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all the particulars, you know, particulates accelerate through that because it narrows and focuses. Mm, I mean, right?
Makes sense, yeah.
So that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And
hang out with Gary, you're going to learn things.
That's right. Well, you think it's a... Yes, you chase business, and we've spent so much time and so much money chasing bad business. We now look when someone quits or we have an issue, we have like a big, you know, spreadsheet where we're looking at all the people that have quit in the past month.
Yeah,
maybe not nine times out of ten. There's legitimate reasons why our, you know, ideal customers quit, but a lot of the time it's people that we should have never enrolled to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're finally losing them. So you think, you know, as a business, you kind of think you have to adjust your metrics too and your KPIs around what success looks like. But you have to be, it's freeing to like put yourself in a box and be like, all right, these are the people I'm going to be talking to at all times. It's okay that it's not for everybody. That it actually makes life a little bit easier. It makes it easier to strategize too.
I want to go back to one other question that's running through my mind. So you talked about this guy in Tacoma, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I made the assumption, maybe erroneously, is Bold Music beyond Charlotte, North Carolina?
Yes, we are, but it's a complicated answer. So we're in Charlotte, and that's where our whole management team, you know, back mm-hmm. office, if you will, is located. We're in Raleigh, North Carolina. We got about 20 teachers in Raleigh. An awesome, awesome team of teachers, an awesome group of students in Raleigh. Really, it's been going great there. Just launched in Atlanta, very, very early on. We're doing a lot of kind of groundwork to get going there, starting to work some. And then we have teachers in those three cities. But the, you know, crazy thing that happened during COVID is we went fully virtual for a while, just for a couple months. We have this virtual capability now, and we do virtual makeup lessons. A few of our teachers during and after the pandemic have moved away for various reasons, and I can't remember how it came about, but we were just like, yeah, well, why do you want to just stick around and stay on the team teaching virtually, especially if your students are okay with it? So we have some students in random places, very few, because we don't advertise outside of Charlotte, Atlanta, Raleigh. But we do have, you know, probably five teachers who are dispersed around, and Mars has like 20 students, you know?
Wow. Cool.
So, but yeah, for the most part, we are local. Like, we don't think of ourselves as all, we think of ourselves as home base of Charlotte, two new markets, Raleigh and Atlanta.
Very cool.
There's a couple things, and we can focus on Charlotte since that's the one where you're most centralized in. I'm curious what Bold is doing to be impacting the music community mm-hmm. in Charlotte.
We are paying out $1 million to musicians. You know what I mean? And yeah. I've had a year.
Yeah.
I've talked to I've done other things, but like let's be honest, like right. musicians need to get paid.
Yeah.
And so we're pretty much tunnel vision on that. And it really took it about 10 years for me to even realize that's the story, because people ask about that. It's like, "Oh, let's go do some, you know, charitable work. Let's go, you know, give lessons to the needy," which we do all of that. We actually teach a ukulele class at the Charlotte Rescue Charlotte Rescue Mission. So we actually do a lot of things that are positive for the community.
Yeah.
But like, let's make no mistake, we're here to help musicians make a living.
And are you seeing a ripple effect from that, of now these people can actually make a living staying as musicians?
Oh, yeah.
So then they're out in the community also?
Yeah. But, you know, being a local, you still... We're just one piece of it. Like, most of these musicians don't make their full-time living with us. It's really hard to do. I mean, mm-hmm. most of our business happens Monday through Thursday, 4 to 8. So you can't really teach full-time, even if you wanted to, because kids are in school.
Yeah.
But what we do is we provide a really consistent, high-paying chunk of your income that then sort of frees you up to be like, oh, it's okay for me to play in a band that maybe isn't going to pay as much, or you know, so we help facilitate making a living as a musician possible.
Interesting.
But then if you just look at the raw numbers, there aren't many, if any, there probably are some, but organizations that are literally putting the amount of money into the pockets of local musicians that we are. And that's really what I care about, because, you know, until we get that right, like, the fun stuff doesn't matter that much.
Yeah. And how does Bold evolve from here? What are things you're trying to do?
We think that 10 years in, we've got something, clearly. We haven't gone out of business. We've grown in revenue every year, and size and all that good stuff. So our goal is to take this to as many markets as we can. So, you know, in the next few years, we want to, you know, kind of be known as the primary premier music lesson company in the Southeast. And then I think, you know, 5-10 years down the line, we want to be all over the country.
So I'm going to piggyback off of a question Gary asked earlier of basically the thrive part for you. What are the things that you enjoy the most that make you come alive? As Bold shifts and grows, right, becomes a staple in the Southeast and all that, how do you see yourself changing in the company?
Great question. I think in order to sort of unlock the next level as a business, we're going to have to continue to get people better and brighter than me. Not that I'm that great, but like, we're going to need to get, you know, kind of up level up the people side. And I think my role will continue to be kind of like the champion of the people, right? So like, making sure that we've got a team that's functioning at a high level, hopefully taking more and more, you know, we've got a six person management team. I mean, it's small enough still to where like one person, two people are out, I'm back in the weeds, you know, to some degree. We have like three out this week, so I'm like very much back in the weeds. So it's like, interruptions happen and I have to jump back in, which is fine and I'm happy to do it. But like, I really want to be focusing my whole time on making this organization better. And so that's kind of where I see it going.
Well, and you had talked earlier about the different stages of the company. So maybe that's fine right now in this stage. But if 8 years from now you still have to jump back in the weeds, it means that something went wrong compared to what you should have done.
Exactly. And I've come a long way. I've learned a ton, especially the past 4 or 5 years. Like, I'm in a way better spot than I was before in terms of just like being able to manage it and having time to like dedicated time to really like work on the business. But it's still, you know, we're not at the human power yet to where that's truly the only thing I have to worry about. Yeah. I'd love to get to that point. Maybe it's not realistic, but I'd love to get to that point.
You know, I just had a thought about him. So I'm looking at Bold. It's also, you remind me, and you could actually probably take a play out of Burn Boot Camp.
Yeah, probably.
Devin Klein.
Yeah.
There are some very similarities between the two of you guys. And, you know, he was doing music lessons in the form of kettlebell swings and stuff like that in parking lots with nothing, you know. And their ability to franchise. But here's the other thing that's interesting that I think has you guys have in common. You both have the humility, you have the drive, but you have the humility to understand, hey, this is what I love to do, and this is what I'm good at, not so much on that. And he paid really close attention, and he actually took a back seat to his wife and had her take over the CEO reins, and basically he and the operational reins, because he wanted to be out among the people, kind of like teacher first with you guys. And he's been on the podcast, so you guys ought to really.
I should totally connect with him. I can tell we have a similar mindset.
I don't even know if he has a formal title at this point.
Yeah, I don't know that he
because
does.
Because he talked about it the same way that you were. He wants to be able to be out there. He doesn't want to have to get strapped to, I'm in meetings all day every day.
Yeah,
you're right. That's a good point.
That could be very interesting.
I love that. Yeah, that'd be great. Hi, Devin.
Yeah, Devin, you rock. He really does. It's just really cool to see. But, you know, Bold could be the next cool franchise. You know, you guys build your infrastructure, you build your processes and that sort of thing. Then you're going to want to talk to Jack Santinello, who's a really good franchise attorney. Mm. Like, really good. Jack, we love
you'll
you.
Come on in 5 years again, and we can talk about
these,
exactly
this
what we
day.
Here.
Yeah. These introductions. Yeah,
this
for
was
sure.
the catalyst.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up here, what's some of the advice that you've learned throughout this journey? Whether it could be to musicians or just budding entrepreneurs, what are some lessons that you really live by that you learned along the way?
There's no silver bullet. Gold bullet, golden gun, so you know what I mean? Like whatever that saying is, like there is no substitute for getting your feet, I'm messing all these sayings up, getting your hands dirty, and hustling through. I mean, there's a reason why this is hard, and there's a reason why entrepreneurship isn't for everybody. Embrace that, embrace the challenge, and there's just not a world where you solve one thing and the next thing needs work. Yeah. So if you're not ready to embrace that, don't bother. And then my argument to that, like I said earlier, is like, who wouldn't want that? It keeps things interesting.
Right.
And admit, I mean, I think I thankfully am wired this way. When things go wrong, the first thing I do is I look in the mirror and I'm like, what did I not do?
Mm.
Where did I go wrong? And I think for the most part, that's a quality that I have, come to be, I think it starts with like the whole imposter syndrome and like, kind of being unsure of yourself, but it actually turns into a big asset. The older you get and the more skill you have in whatever line of work that you're in, because it really makes, it's a very good exercise. There's almost never a situation where something external happens not to my liking that I didn't play a role in. And acknowledging that is critical, and learning from it is critical.
That's an attribute of a great leader, right?
Yeah,
because
I think so.
People, leaders that don't have that, their first is extrinsic. They're going to look at their people, and who do I blame for this?
Yeah. So. It's yourself. Like, if your people in a business, in your organization, if your people are screwing up, and it's your fault.
Yeah, that's right.
You've either, and it might be that you have to go all the way back to just you hired the wrong people to begin with, but like, it's on you.
Yeah.
So I see that, I've seen other entrepreneurs really struggle with that. I don't know if it's a pride, I think it's a pride ego thing that's really rooted in insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just am, of my many faults, that's one of the things I think that thankfully I have that ability to really not, to be able to look in the mirror and be like, that was me. That's on me.
Yep.
And it doesn't, I rarely am like losing sleep over it. It doesn't bother me that much. I'm fine with admitting I'm wrong. That's kind of an important piece of advice I would give.
I got another question for you before we wrap. And if somebody hasn't noticed this in this conversation, like you're asleep or you got this at 2x speed, but you've got a sense of grounding, humility, the fact that you even just said, hey, I just want to be a good dad. And 8 months into this new gig, right?
New gig.
It's a new gig.
It is.
Right?
It totally
it's
is.
It's a whole new gig. But you've got this positivity. I'm just curious, like, how have you cultivated that?
Definitely have always been, it's interesting. I have a big history of like depression and crazy stuff in my in my family.
Really?
I'm an anxious person, but thankfully not depressed.
Yeah.
Thankfully not depressed. I don't know. I've always been kind of like, I've always been a positive grass is greener.
Yeah.
Grass is fine on this side.
Okay.
But,
there you go.
I'm not really sure, where that came from. And sometimes it's hard, but I think by and large, especially when things get really stressful and really, thankfully again, have this ability to just like pull myself out and be like, okay, game on, this is a challenge. Let's figure this out. I'm not really sure like where that came from. I guess I got to give props to my parents.
Yeah. Cool. This is, well, good job, mom and dad. Seems like you did a pretty good job raising this kid. So.
We're going to put links in the show notes and all that, but for the people listening, where can they go to check you out and connect with you? And same thing with Bold.
So you can, for Bold Music, is boldmusiclessons.com is our website. We're very active on Instagram and Facebook. Instagram at Bold Music, and my personal Instagram is probably a good way to connect with me personally, even though I don't post much, is Bold Music George. So there you go. Perfect. That was a branding. You know what I mean? I changed my username recently.
George, thanks so much for coming on. This was great.
Thank you. It's been awesome. Really appreciate it.